Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Recording and progress.
Great.
It's very exciting, this, because you and I are doing this podcast on our own without the guiding adult hand of Alex Gold, who's normally the producer in the background.
As discussed in the past, a woke stag do.
It's on a woke stag do. Can you imagine, listeners, what that possibly consists of?
They're going to bed early with a good book.
Yeah, I thought they probably will. Anyway, so I was just looking around to see what we might talk about, and I was just looking at Google News. And Google News has got, you know, normal sections. It's got news, weather, sport, entertainment. You look under entertainment, you look at the rich tapestry of extraordinary entertainment stories, i.e. not very exciting at all. And then you look on the BBC site, and it's also got news, sport, but it doesn't have entertainment, Mark. What does it have instead of entertainment? It has culture.
Oh, Lord.
Culture. I just thought, that's very
less thrilling somehow. It feels like you're going to get a lecture.
It does really, you know, particularly when you look under entertainment look under culture, and the first story you see concerns the fact that a couple of kind of soap actors have split up or something's happened in the world of K-pop or TV detective fiction. You think people are really pushing the word culture, aren't they, really? They've taken it a bit far. Don't you ever think that generally speaking, everybody in entertainment nowadays just takes themselves far too seriously? Isn't that the case? It seems to me to be the case. Everybody calls themselves artists nowadays.
And activists.
Well, there is that. There's that as well. And
they do. I think people are inclined not to try and be funny, because if you're funny, you lay yourself open to saying something that might offend. So I think people tend to be terribly serious and terribly self-interested and self-promotional, actually.
Anyway, one of the things I was reading was Liam Gallagher defending the length of his album with John Squire, which I think is 10 tracks. And I think the NME was saying, boo, swizz, that's not sufficient. And Liam was saying, no, it's absolutely fine. And I thought it was quite interesting in the light of the fact that this weekend is the 51st anniversary. That's a catchy anniversary, isn't it? 51. 51st anniversary of the release of The Wailers' Catch a Fire. Came out in 1973. Do you know, I can remember, because this was the first reggae record that was marketed at rock fans. You'd definitely have to say that. You know, Chris Blackwell's been...
Yeah, marketed at sort of white, middle-class students, absolutely, almost, actually.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, definitely. And I can remember going to listen to it in what was then the HMV shop in Wood Green, North London. Think back to a time where there actually was an HMV shop in Wood Green, North London. That really takes you back. And anyway, in those days, I was trying to remember this the other day. When you went in shops like that, they hadn't got headphones or anything like that. You went into a semi-phone box, didn't you, at the side of the place, where there would be this plywood hood that you'd stick your head into, and one really inadequate little tinny speaker mounted on pegboard would play, you know, the assistant had put on the record deck.
You could also hear the Fat Mattress album in the next door booth, couldn't you? So it was
absolutely
pure sonic experience.
It wasn't, but I can remember hearing it, and you know, they started side one. It's Concrete Jungle there, and Slave Driver, and I think we probably got two tracks. I think two tracks was pretty much all you were allowed.
Yeah.
Before the rather disapproving
loon pants would come and sling you out.
No, it wouldn't be anybody in loon pants in those days. Not in the HMV shops, Oxford Street. Not in 1973. I don't think it'd be loon pants at all. Actually, might even have been somebody in a company blazer.
Yeah, might be wearing a tie.
Yeah. But you weren't allowed to listen to much. But I can remember, oh, that's enough for me. But I wanted the record, and I went and bought the record, and I've still got the record here now in its original Zippo sleeve. You've got yours.
Yeah, I've just dug mine out with the Zippo lighter top. And I think only the first 20,000 were pressed like that with a little rivet, so you could lift up the top, because it was unbelievably expensive, wasn't it?
Well, it's like if they're doing any album cover that involves really individual work, this is the back in the days of album covers, that involves anything difficult, it's immensely expensive. If you do more, if it's a success, it's expensive, because you have to keep on producing them. And famously, was it Shep Gordon who was originally the manager of Alice Cooper? When Alice Cooper first broke through, and you no doubt remember the album. Was it School's Out? Was the album called
With
the School?
Pair of knickers on it, wasn't it?
Which the record was inside a pair of knickers.
Yeah.
You know, were they paper or what? I can't remember.
I think so. Yeah.
And I think they actually had to be. I think EMI did the manufacture at the time. EMI Hayes did the manufacture at the time. And the manufacture involved troops of middle-aged ladies wearing nylon overalls, you know, basically.
All tutting to themselves.
Absolutely. No, I think they did.
No daughter of mine will ever see.
I think they actually refused to do it. I think they were done somewhere else. You know, it was so controversial. Anyway, those processes had to be done by hand, and consequently, they're very expensive to be done. And so after the first 10,000, 20,000 or whatever of Catch a Fire, it's repackaged with the picture of Bob Marley on the cover, and it becomes Bob Marley and the Wailers, which is kind of a different thing.
Yeah,
but it's interesting.
It was sold as the Wailers, wasn't it?
Well, here's the interesting thing. What I wanted to just talk about was the steps that Chris Blackwell took to make it appear reassuringly like a rock album. Because, you know, the Wailers, Bob Marley and the Wailers, have made a number of albums. I think they made five before that had all been available one way or another in the UK, you know, via Trojan. And Trojan's covers always looked cheap and cheerful, and generally had some young woman, you know, almost bare-breasted, carrying a machine gun through a fake jungle somewhere. That's how they marketed this kind of stuff.
And Blackwell, attractively.
Blackwell decided, because Blackwell, you know, is the British equivalent of Jack Holtzman in the States, the man behind Elektra. who realized the importance of packaging. That he had to make it feel like a really desirable thing to walk out the shop with. So he took various steps. One was commissioning this fantastically expensive, noteworthy original cover, which got it talked about. But the other thing he did, they'd made this record in Jamaica. Well, they did two things. They'd sent over the tapes from Jamaica, and then he overdubbed guitar from Wayne Perkins. There's three guitar solos.
Yeah, because your white middle-class rock audience wanted and expected guitar solos.
Absolutely. He wanted to be like a Traffic album or whatever. And the other thing he did, which I do think is interesting, was he reduced the number of tracks. And that's why I think this has got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's just got 9 tracks on.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's got 9 tracks. And if you look at the earlier Bob Marley and the Wailers albums on Trojan, they've all got 12 tracks, which was somehow, it was rock albums didn't have that many tracks. You know what I mean? Because it was supposed to sound better as a consequence of putting less signal on the side and so forth. And also it carried with it the kind of implied message that you were going to get long enough track 3 to get into it. You know what I mean? At that time, nobody wanted anything quick, did they? You know what I mean? It's the idea you could luxuriate
I remember you would settle down to listen to this record and you would carve out the next 2 hours or whatever, just sit down and do this without any distractions at all. So, you know, you were immersing yourself in it, weren't you?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, so that it's classic. Chris Blackwell has gone into history as the kind of the music man, you know what I mean? The defender of the artist's pure vision or whatever. Well, Chris Blackwell, you know, I'm a huge admirer of Chris Blackwell. He achieved an enormous amount. But he wasn't above a trick or two, was he?
No.
You know, he knew what it would take to shift the perception of a group like the Wailers.
And but also the sleeve note was so brilliantly written, don't you think? The way it explained, it says their name, the Wailers, perfectly fits this unique group from Jamaica. It describes both their explosive musical drive and the message they bring from the ghettos of Kingston. Now, that would have really connected, wouldn't it, with the audience he was looking for?
Yeah.
You know, he's talking about... their songs and arrangements echo the wailings of the ghetto, not only in Jamaica, but indeed in any concrete jungle anywhere. It's fantastic. It talks about rock steady they're also the first group to present the Rudy songs that introduce the reggae beats. You get a kind of potted history, don't you, of the kind of the musical and sort of political roots. It's really good.
Well, it was a hugely successful case of launching a previously unfamiliar group and an unfamiliar sound to an entirely new audience. And because it just largely achieved it through that cover, because as we've said before on the podcast, is there was a whole drama around the cover, wasn't there? You know, you saw it in a record shop window. You went in to look at it in the rack. You visited somebody who had a copy and you actually handled it. And you got inside it.
You opened it up. Exactly.
It was immense part of the kind of it was the marketing message, wasn't it? It was the cover. There was no video. You didn't see them on television.
No.
Anything like that. You didn't even read very much about them in the press. Or what you read in the press was very much about that cover. So
Are there any other examples of records that were kind of tinkered with after recording to that extent? I couldn't really think of any.
I can't, but I'm sure them. I'm sure
like the Sound of Silence, but that was a different thing, wasn't it? You know, that was redone with a rhythm section on it and then put out. But I don't think it was on that album. It wasn't on that. It was just two different versions of the song, weren't there?
Yeah, well, that was the one that was the hit, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And that all happened because Paul Simon had left and come to England and had completely forgotten about it, you know. But it's also a reminder of both of these cases, you know. So this record, Wailers, comes out in 73. Is it 73? And so when's the massive breakthrough of Bob Marley and the Wailers? 1975, 2 years later.
75 with the live album, wasn't it, really?
2 years later. It's no time at all, really.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's the same thing with Paul Simon and folk rock in the 1960s. Whatever happened incredibly quickly, didn't it? You know,
it did.
And you had to get on with it. Whereas, you know, nowadays things are not quite so speedy. You've also... You've sent me a note about Ron Wood. Is it Ron Wood's anniversary?
Well, it's Romans? Ron Wood's anniversary 49 years ago, another round figure, of joining the Stones. Yeah, he joined the Stones on April the 14th in 1975. And I remember seeing them twice in 1976 when he was the new boy. Weirdly, he's still the new boy.
He's still the new boy. Of course he is.
No, I just thought it was interesting because I wondered if that was just not the most jammy thing to ever happen to anybody in the history of rock and roll. Because Ronnie Wood's been in that group now for 49 years. He has brought in principally because he was a kind of bridge between Keith and Mick and got on with both, but was Keith Richards' great pal. And because he had the right hair and he looked right, he subsequently had co-writing credits on, I think it's about 12 songs, I think, Dance, Black Limousine, One Hit to the Body, etc. He must get absolutely unimaginable wages. And also in a position where he's got those side projects going on, the occasional Faces reunions and the solo albums and his art career. But you could argue that he's had 50 years with almost no responsibility at all. Because he doesn't have to carry the can, does he? Sorry, I'm having a little cough here. You know, he's never required to produce anything show-stopping on stage. And he's very rarely kind of has to be wheeled out on the interview front. His main job is simply to look the part. And isn't that a bit of a meal ticket for the last half century? I mean, it's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful. But that is just a dream job. He never has to carry the weight of the Rolling Stones on his shoulder, does he? Just has to be part of the look and sound of the Rolling Stones. And also, you look back at Rolling Stones, and there's virtually no moment when you can hear anything they've played in the last 50 years and go, well, that's classic Ronnie Wood. He's just woven into the fabric of it, isn't he?
Do you think he thinks in his moments of, you know, secret confession to himself in the long marches of the night when he's thinking to himself, does he think, I'm a member of the Rolling Stones? Or does he think, I hang about with the Rolling Stones? You know what I mean? Because, you know, he's kind of, he's to me, well, maybe it's just to old gits like you and me. He's the bloke who joined the Rolling Stones. I can't even think of Mick Taylor as a proper Rolling Stone.
No, you know, not what I mean?
You know, to me, the Rolling Stones, the original five, and nothing will ever really shift that. In my view. But I mean, you say he gets unimaginable wages, but I'm sure he gets immensely well paid.
But he must, and on the live front. Must,
okay.
For a long time he was on wages, wasn't he?
Yeah, but here's the point. But he only gets that when they tour. You know, basically, you know, Rolling Stones tour, you know, they spend 6 months planning it, and then they spend 6 months doing it or whatever it is, and then there's a large check. And then nothing happens for the next 2 years, probably. And there's probably no revenue coming during the subsequent 2 years, you know. And so, you know, we just have no idea of these people's attitude to money. Although I got a glimpse the other day, I was reading an interview with Pete Townsend, and he says, if I'm really honest, I've been touring for the money, you know, because the Who, you know, Townsend and Daltrey have been touring one way or another last few years. He said, my idea of an ordinary lifestyle is pretty elevated. I thought that was quite well put, that is, actually. Because basically,
that's very honest.
You know, what would seem like a lot of money to you and me wouldn't seem like quite so much if you're living the life of Pete Townsend and have the outgoings of Pete Townsend. You know, and probably the same thing applies with Ron Wood. You know, I don't get the feeling any of these people think, I'm sitting on enough money that I need never lift a finger for the rest of my life. I just don't think it works like that.
But it's your point that they've got enough money, I'm sure, to be perfectly comfortably off, but they haven't got enough money to maintain the lifestyle that currently operating at. And that's the important thing. No musician ever wants to feel they're downsizing.
No.
It's that whole thing about Mick Jagger. I can't remember how many houses Mick Jagger has. I think it's 5 houses around the world. He doesn't want to wake up one morning and only have 4.
But here's the thing that's massively changed, Mark. Rock stars used to, really successful rock stars in the 70s and 80s, whatever, used to hang around with kind of movie stars and other rock stars and sports stars and so forth. But what's happened in the last 30 years or whatever is a new category of super rich has emerged. And so if you're Paul McCartney or Mick Jagger or whatever, you must regularly go to a party or whatever, or move into a house or check into a hotel, and you notice that you're next door to somebody who is, In the words of Harry Enfield, is it considerably richer than Yao?
Yao, that's right. Yeah.
that's the way it is.
Footballers being a main
top footballers and top, people who've made Mark Zuckerberg or whatever, people who made that kind of money,
.com billionaires.
It's a totally different thing.
It's true, rockstars used to be your image of the absolute top of the financial pile. There was nothing more glamorous than Rod Stewart, Florida or whatever.
But there is now. I was writing about this not long ago, and I noticed that I think if you look in the homes of all these, massive rock stars of the 60s and 70s, they're all now occupied by kind of Middle Eastern sheikhs or dot-com billionaires, have all had them knocked down because they weren't quite big enough. Because the definition of being massively rich has changed, hugely.
What we're actually saying is that poor old Ronnie Wood is scraping a living.
He's scraping
and
by.
Desperately hoping to get back on the road, which he is.
So, he's getting by. And I don't know. As I've said before, I do recommend if anybody is down at the local charity shop and they find a copy of Ron Wood's autobiography, which came out about 10 years ago, I can't remember the name of it, and it's a book I highly recommend because you can read it as comedy or as tragedy. Exactly the same book. Completely the same book. You can make a film based on that book. You think, now look at it. Now look at what's going on in this scene. And imagine you're a normal person. You would find it horrific. You know what I mean? Whereas in the world of Ron, it's just another crazy day in the world of Ron Wood, 77 or whatever he is.
Yes.
Whatever he is nowadays. Anyway, so that's April the 14th. No, what did you say? 1975.
Ronnie Wood joined the Stones.
He joined the Rolling Stones.
Remember them at Earl's Court. Appearing out of the middle of an enormous mechanical flower, I think it was.
Oh, yes.
Did you see that tour?
Yeah. No, I didn't, but I've seen
it. And it opened up, and there was Mick Jagger, there was Keith Richards. It was so exciting. We were in the second row at Earl School, and there was Ronnie Wood, the new boy, wearing a pair of moccasins. I can remember.
Oh, yes.
Sort of harem, baggy harem pants and moccasins.
Oh,
yeah, I'm fairly sure that Keith Richards had a Bob Marley and the Wailers T-shirt, which I thought was very cool.
While we're talking about that tour, was that the tour? We're talking about underwear earlier and the Alice Cooper, the packaging of the Alice Cooper album. Wasn't it on tour around about that time in Madison Square Garden, I think, in New York, that Mick Jagger had no underwear prior to going on stage? And so borrowed from New York scene maker and writer, is it Lisa Anderson? Is it Lisa Anderson?
Who was in the dressing room, wasn't she?
She slipped off her knickers and these were washed, dried, and then were worn by Mick Jagger on stage in front of him.
That's quite an exciting thing to tell your grandchildren. show people a picture on stage that night and say, guess what he's wearing?
Yeah, your grandma's
grand.
Your grandma's
crazy days.
talking about other anniversaries and connected with live entertainment, you were talking about, you were saying how sad you were that you missed the glory day of the package
well, that's
tour.
Right. I noticed there was a package tour happening pretty much. When was it? It was the, again,
it's 1967.
1967, yeah. I just noticed it was Jimi Hendrix was touring with the Walker Brothers, Cat Stevens and Engelbert Humperdinck.
Fantastic.
And they all appeared on that night, on this anniversary, at the Odeon Blackpool. Tickets, £5. Tickets were either 5 or 10 shillings. And wow. I just thought, God, I would love to have seen that. I was kind of too young for all that. I mean, I never saw any of those. By the time I was kind of going to see gigs, it was just... It would have been Soft Machine, supported by Andy Roberts, supported by Brinsley Schwartz. But you actually saw some. I mean, I love that idea that you went to see.
Well, I sent you. Did you get these things that I put? I sent it on the document. I found the actual programs online for two things that I saw. I think if you refresh that document, Mark, you might see it.
Oh right.
I went to see the first proper gig I ever went to see, and we were talking about this only the other day because we talked to Rich Thompson about his upcoming tour, and he was saying one of the first gigs he ever saw was Chuck Berry and Carl Perkins, and I saw that tour as well. And we're also talking to a few weeks ago, talking to Steve Howe from Yes. And Steve, it was also Steve Howe's first tour, probably. And so I found the
Here
the
it is.
Program here. So if you look at the
man
two of them,
man. God save the
no,
queen.
No, the one. No, hold on a second, Mark. Right, the one below. Look at the one below first.
Oh yeah.
And this is the first gig I ever went to. It says program, and it has a compare. Don't forget all these shows. Package stores always had a compere, some kind of Norman Vaughan yes. lookalike in a shabby dinner jacket who told not very funny jokes about the Rolling Stones. Anyway, in this case, it was somebody called Larry Burns. And then the program goes, 1, the Nashville Teens. 2, the other two. 3, Carl Perkins. 4, the Animals. 5, the Swinging Blue Jeans.
And then interval.
The interval.
That's wonderful. So you go and get a kind of orange squash.
You get a Kia Ora.
Ora and a packet of crisps. A salt bag.
And then the second half is 6, the Dominoes. 7, King Size Taylor, because it was King Size Taylor and the Dominoes. They were a very popular Liverpool group. And then so that's 7. And then 8, Chuck Berry. And as Richard Thompson said the other day, Chuck Berry would have played for all the 20 minutes, you know, done like 6 songs or something like that. But he had nothing to compare it to at all. But here's the point, Mark. That show was the 6 o'clock show. Or
so 6:30. They went on and did that again 2 hours later.
And so basically they had all the youngsters. So I was like 14 or something. And so we were the youngsters. We went to the early show. And we would be out of the place by 7:45 or something. And then they'd start bringing people in and do the whole thing again at 8 o'clock for a bunch of Teds, probably. People smelling of Tetleys. and you know, so that was the first. But I've also found I saw, I think probably the same year, actually, I saw the Rhythm and Blues show because clearly somebody... And the time thought, the names aren't quite huge enough. We're going to sell it generically. We're going to sell it as the Rhythm and Blues Show because Rhythm and Blues was the hot thing. And so that is presented by Larry Parnes and introduced by Dave Caffey. Can you imagine what Dave Caffey was like? And then you got Blues by
Again,
5.
A blazer, I think. And lots of kind of... you know, it's kind of end of the pier comedy, would it?
Yeah, probably. But nothing, nothing blue at all.
No.
And then Blues by 5, the Mark Lehman 5, who were my personal cult favourites.
You had their name written on your school bag.
On my haversack, yes. then Wayne Gibson and the Dynamic Sound, of whom I have no memory, then the Downliners sect, who I do remember. Downliners sect, who used to dress up like Sherlock Holmes and used to wear deerstalkers and play harmonicas and shake maracas.
Funny
and
old pipes, that's right.
The Spencer Davis Group, who we talked about previously with little Stevie Winwood, who was 15 years old. Whatever it was. Then Bern Elliott and his clan, no longer Bern Elliott and the Fenmen, and then the Soul Sisters, and finally, in bold, Man for a Man. And then
God Save the Queen.
God Save the Queen.
Isn't that absolutely incredible?
You know.
See, I'm so envious. Oh, that must have been just brilliant. Also, I like the idea that you're only seeing people for 15, 20 minutes, if that, you know. You can watch those YouTube clips of the, you know, Enemy Poll Winners Award at Wembley, and it's just fantastic. You want to see Dusty Springfield followed by whoever it is, Cilla Black followed by Swinging Blue Jeans or whoever, and then the Beatles and the Stones.
It wasn't just in England. I've got an example here from my best-selling book, Overpaid, Oversex, and Over There. When talk about the Who going to America in the mid-60s, and I'm going to read you this. At first, their American agent Frank Barcelona was so keen to get them booked anywhere. He wangled them onto a Murray the K show at the RKO Theater in New York.
Yeah.
Here they were billed to appear with, are you ready, Mitch Ryder, Wilson Pickett, the Blues Magoos, Mandala, Chicago Loop, Jim and Gene, the Blues Project, Cream, and some comedians.
Fantastic.
That's all that. And the idea of this show...
For a dollar or whatever.
This show was that it ran five times a day for 10 days. Great. The initial running order called for The Who to do four numbers. When they argued that this was insufficient time to put over what they were about, the four were reduced to two. In the face of this limitation... Pete Townsend, sorry, I'm laughing at my own words, reasoned that the only thing that mattered about the show was the climax. Wearing a jacket he had jerry-rigged with twinkling fairy lights, he threw his guitar up in the air during My Generation. The audience, not unreasonably, waited for him to catch it and were amazed to see it fall to the stage. And, you know, and basically that he just used to destroy his guitar and then Keith would destroy his drum kit. And that was the Who's show. And then we'd have
to then have to repair the drum kit immediately to get ready to destroy it again for the fourth time.
Or five times a day.
Absolutely,
they did that. You know, it's happy days. You know,
I know.
Happy days.
I so wish I'd seen all that. You know, the smash hits poll winners show that we used to run when we were still at EMAP. We're kind of like that, weren't they? When you just two songs each and all these tracks. That was just a brilliant package. And those 80s nostalgia tours that have been going recently are much the same, where you get 3 minutes of Howard Jones, 6 minutes of Nick Kershaw, whatever. But happy days. God.
Happy days.
Wouldn't it be lovely if that came back?
Who knows? It might. So I've been reading a film memoir, Mark, which I've been recommending to you, called if anybody ever enjoyed things like William Goldman's Adventures in the Screen Trade,
which is fantastic.
Yes. There's a new book called Hits, Flops, and Other Illusions by Edward Zwick. And Edward Zwick, who was a TV producer turned film director and so forth, and was responsible for things like 30-something, you may have remembered back in the day. And then subsequently directed films like Glory. And was an original producer on Shakespeare in Love and worked with all kinds of people. And it's particularly good on the business, the kind of economy of stars and dealing with stars. And I was particularly taken by the bit where he talks about he comes across, somebody's written a script in Hollywood. Somebody's had an idea for a film called Shakespeare in Love, and it's about Shakespeare as a struggling entrepreneur, actor, producer, director, and a bit of a knockabout comedy. And somebody's got that idea, and he thinks, that's a good idea. And so he gets involved with it as a producer. But he thinks, I think it needs something more in terms of the writing. And so he contacts Tom Stoppard, no less, and amazingly comes over and, you know, gets Tom Stoppard to write another version of the script, which he does. And by then, it's being talked about around Hollywood. And Julia Roberts, who is the new thing.
But she only had one hit at the time.
Well, hold on. This is Pretty Woman, wasn't it? This is it, Pretty Woman.
This is 1990, so, and she would have been, what, 22, 23?
Oh, well, hold on. She indicates that she's interested. And so suddenly the studios are really interested, you know, they want to do it. So it's going to be done. It's going to be done in the UK. You know, people are hired. They start building the Globe Theatre. They do absolutely all this. They're committing millions to it because Julia's on board to do it. And so he has to come over with Julia Roberts, first class, obviously. And, you know, during the flight overnight, probably, you know, drink is taken. And she says, she talks to him about how excited she is about it. But she thinks only one person can play Shakespeare, and that's Daniel Day-Lewis. And God, because he knows that Daniel Day-Lewis is not going to do it because he's committed to some other movie or whatever. Anyway, they come over, and they are booked in to a hotel that you probably remember because it used to be the kind of the place that the music business, the entertainment business used to use as the hotel of choice. Place called the Halcyon in Notting Hill.
I do.
And it's all very shishy. Anyway, they get booked into their suites and so forth. And you know, next morning, down in the bar and the public areas, they have every young, handsome, talented English actor. And they're all young. You know, they got Colin Firth.
Hugh Grant, Sean Bean, I think, Ralph Fiennes.
Yes, Jeremy Northam, I think, all these people. And one way or another.
Glowering at each other, trying to be pally.
Well, they probably, no, because actors are quite used to that kind of thing. Yeah, that's what they do. They all turn up for an audition. They all see, they all know the people who get the part if they don't get the part. They can deal with it, no trouble at all.
Yeah.
And anyway, she either grudgingly agrees to read with them or won't come out of her room or whatever. And then one morning, Zwick gets up. Could you put me through to Miss Roberts' suite? I'm afraid she checked out this morning.
She just left.
She's just flown back. And then she's told her agent when she gets back, Julia doesn't want to do it anymore. She doesn't want to do it anymore. They have to destroy the sets that have been built. They've built the Globe Theatre. It's destroyed.
Incredible.
Because as soon as Julia Roberts doesn't want to do it, the studios don't want to do it, whole things crumble. And here's the point. How old is Julia Roberts when she has this staggering power?
She was something like 23 or something.
She was 23.
Absolutely.
She was 23. Can you now you think, I was thinking about this the other day. I don't know. When do you think, something interesting to reflect on this, when do you think is the age when you were at your most stupid? Do you ever think about it? I think about this a lot. I think I was at my most stupid when I was about 21. You know what I mean?
Well, it's a combination of naivety, but also
thinking you know everything
and self-delusion, isn't it? And thinking you know everything. That's right. So it probably is around then.
It's around that time.
About that now. Why? I can't help but think that someone should make a movie about the making of Shakespeare in Love.
Oh, he could.
Harvey Weinstein.
Then comes along.
Zwick.
Well, Zwick's still there. Still gets a producer
Not
credit.
Not as a director.
Yeah, he has a producer credit. And when Tom Stoppard got the Oscar, which I think he did for best screenplay, he thanked Edward Zwick from the stage, which meant a lot to Edward Zwick and would have made Harvey Weinstein very, very cross indeed.
Yeah, it would.
But
it would.
You, You could definitely do a film
but
about
that. But, I mean,
by
that time, I think that the Kate Winslet was offered the role, wasn't she, of Viola? And then there was Winona Ryder, and then Diane Lane, and then Robin Wright. And so the whole thing was absolutely chaotic. It always makes you think, when you look at the finished film, which I saw actually recently, not long ago, it's really, really good.
Mm.
And you look at that and think, how extraordinary that this ever came off. There were so many things that could and did go wrong.
Well, yeah, it's just the way it is. I tell you, it's a good book if you're looking for that kind of read. It's called Hits, Flops, and Other Illusions by Edward Zwick, because he's got his memories of dealing with all kinds of films and all kinds of stars and all kinds of politics. And it doesn't make you think how interesting it is that music never produces books like that, and Adventures in the Screen Trade. And I suppose it's because, you know, films, it's just a very public medium, isn't it? Whatever you do, you know, it's going to be done on a grand scale, on a big set, and with a load of people watching.
50 people with clipboards are going to be watching you.
Yeah. You know, whereas, you know, most of the recording is a very, you know, it's a very private process, isn't it? Nobody knows really what
it's
goes
just two
on.
Two people, it's 3 o'clock in the morning in a room somewhere. But this is like, if you don't come out of your trailer on a film set, everyone's going to know, aren't they?
So it just turns out stories, you know, because a film set is a kind of, it's a drama in itself, isn't it, you know?
I love those stories about films that you discover things that were actually happening on set, and it kind of changes the way you see the scenes. There's a scene in Some Like It Hot when Marilyn Monroe splits up with the Tony Curtis character, who she thinks is genuinely offering her some kind of marriage proposal. Do you remember that? And comes into the room with Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis. And she's weeping, and she's going through the drawers in the cupboard, trying to find a little bottle of booze. And she was so out of it during that thing that they had to write in the bottom of each drawer the line that she has to say. So every time she opens a drawer, she looks into it and turns around and says, "Where's the bottle?" or whatever, you know. You think, once you know that, you just look at that completely differently.
Absolutely. It's like if you watched Tony Hancock, you know, loads of things they'd been successful on the radio with. They subsequently did TV for TV, and he would not learn lines. And so if you see Tony Hancock in any of those wonderful things, he's never looking in the right place at all. He's looking beyond the camera to somebody who's holding up the cue card, which has got his line there.
Yes. Yeah,
you can see his eyes, you know, wander around doing that, you know.
Marlon Brando in Apocalypse Now wouldn't learn the lines. And he had an eyepiece. He's shot kind of in half dark, isn't he? And there's pauses between each line. And you know that in that pause, somebody is reading his next line into his ear. And he's trotting it out.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
So what else have we got to talk about? There's a very interesting feature in a piece in the New York Times about a company called Master Tape Rescue, who have set up to find lost multi-track recordings. Because, and I was interested in this, because I always wanted to do a program for the radio called Where Is Everything? Because we kind of assume that we know all the tapes and all the originals of everything are all being kept in good order in some filing cabinet somewhere. And, of course, they're not, you know. And that's what Master Tape Rescue have discovered. They found an entire Who album, didn't they?
Who by Numbers was
Who by Numbers, the original Master Tapes.
With lots of unreleased songs. Amazing. They found, I think, some Jimi Hendrix sessions. They found some Billie Holiday tapes. Chicago Blues, a big collection of live recordings like David Bowie, REM, Iggy Pop. It's just so interesting, isn't it? That, you know, because you wonder what happens to the master tapes of, I mean, you assume that all master tapes have been kept somewhere, but are they? I mean, if you tried to find the master tape of The Garden of Jane DeLorney by Trees or something, where would that actually
Well, it's
be?
Probably be been found. It's probably been found because Trees are, you know, there's a considerable following for Trees now.
Yeah,
50 years later, that there wasn't at the time, you know.
Yeah.
And so somebody probably has tracked it down. But, you know, the amount of stuff that is recorded, which is just kind of unremarkable and appears to have You know, most records, I always used to say this, and I think it's still true. Most records you literally can't give away. You know, literally nobody wants them until, you know, for one reason or another, either, you know, cult interest or inclusion on the soundtrack or God knows what, draws it to people's attention. And so things are either massively valuable or completely valueless, aren't they, really? And that's the problem with tracking down old stuff, that you can't trust what it says on the outside of the box, because that's just something that's been scribbled by a tape op, you know, 50 years earlier. You know, it's what he or she thinks is inside the box. It might not necessarily be this. I remember when I was doing the Abbey Road book, I spent some time talking to the tape librarian there, down in the basement. And this guy, kind of haunted figure. And I thought, this guy is the anorak's anorak, you know what I mean? Because basically, wouldn't you love to have a job going through all the old tapes at Abbey Road? Wouldn't you love that? Well, no, you wouldn't if you met this guy, you know? Because you think, what do you do all day? He sits in a room, he says, people send me old VHSs of things from Switzerland or whatever they say. Because what happens is people are always wanting to chuck stuff away. They're always wanting to chuck stuff in a skip, but they're always haunted by the fact, by the worry that they may be chunking away something.
Well, didn't that happen with Olympics?
With Olympic.
In 1987, did they throw away incredible stuff,
well,
I think?
Well, stones, lead. Well, yeah, but there was stuff that they were left with. You see, because, you know what, we've all done this in the world of magazines. You've got a filing cabinet full of stuff. Will somebody take that away? Well, no, nobody will take it away.
Well, I'll chuck it.
Yeah. That's what happens, you know. And this guy was constantly being sent stuff by people saying, I don't think there's anything of value here, but just in case, I'm sending it to you. And of course, what's the only way to check? Somebody's got to sit down and listen to the thing. And you haven't just got to listen to it, Mark. You've got to put on the big old reel-to-reel. You've got to listen to the 40 minutes that is there, and then you've got to listen to the other 25 minutes of blank tape, just in case, at the end of it,
there's some little nugget, somebody's
playing a keyboard, and then you hear a voice, you think, oh, God, was that Paul McCartney? Of course, it's not. It's probably a member of Herman's Hermits or something. Yes. You know what I mean? You just don't know. You've got no information whatsoever. You've got whatever it says on the box. Probably bears no resemblance to what's actually on the tape. So, you know, what these guys, Master Tape Rescue, are offering is they're prepared to put the time in to listening to that damn stuff, and also being knowledgeable enough to say, do you know, that could be
worth
it. Is that Santana or whatever, you know?
Because it is a massive goldmine, isn't it? If you did find, as these guys did, unreleased Who tracks.
Well, it's not a huge goldmine because you don't own the copyright. And so let's say
it's a huge goldmine for someone.
Well, it wouldn't. It's not a huge goldmine. It's a goldmine. Yeah. But it's not enough to make Master Tape Rescue a fortune, I wouldn't have thought, you know. Because if you found a fabulous unreleased two-track from 1966, what's that worth? I can't believe it's a huge amount of money. It's not the Beatles.
It's worth something in terms of putting out another box set with
some
track on it. It's just
the lost tapes.
The lost tapes.
Yeah. And that's Master Tape Rescue, so, you know, best of luck to them in their continuing endeavours. What else have we got to plug, Mark, that we've done?
Just terrific. We met up with Neil, our old pal from Smash Hits, when was it? A couple of weeks ago now, and recorded a two-parter, which is really, really good, I think. He's got so many theories about everything. Such an original view of stuff, and he's just so funny.
I can't get over the idea of listening to it again, because the idea, well, it's just you and me talking to Neil. You know, it's like a lunch hour in 1983 or something like that.
Well, there's a great irony in that. There's one bit where we go off on a tangent. We talk about the little cafes we used to go to off Carnaby Street. We talk about the Bombonera, the Bombo, and La Perla, the people we had lunch with. We're talking about this tiny little world for an international audience 40 years later. I'm just trying to think of all the Pet Shop Boys have put it on all their socials, and so it's doing very well, actually. Being listened to all over the world, and they're just supposed to be thinking, what on earth are they talking about?
Dude, to quote Tony Hancock, friends all over the world. None in here, none. I'll start that again. Friends all over the world. None in this country, but friends all over the world. That's what he says. Okay, we'll be back in a minute with birthday guest Chuck Lonson.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
So we're now joined by a birthday guest who is about to toss a log on the conversational fire, and we're beamed into Savannah, Georgia. It's the great Chuck Lonson. Chuck, it's lovely to see you. So what is the thing you wish to discuss?
Well, I figured if I'm going to throw anything on the fire, it might as well be gasoline. So the topic I've chosen in my worst Janis Joplin impersonation are songs of great social and political impact.
All right.
Mercedes-Benz.
Really, I was... I saw a short article the other day about somebody saying that Neil Young had talked Joni Mitchell into putting her music back on Spotify or one of those services, streaming services. And of course, they had all pulled their stuff from Spotify in protest of something.
But Joe Rogan, was it?
I think it was Joe Rogan, yeah.
Yeah, it was.
Who was, I think, the biggest money maker for Spotify. So they didn't seem to care who pulled. But everybody's back now, and I'm kind of curious if it's just money that's brought them running back, or did they see such a dip in income that they figured they better be back there where everybody is watching them?
Well, wouldn't you want your stuff to be available? I mean, I think you would. It'd be like saying, let's withdraw it from this shop window. You know, I think you'd want people to listen to you.
Yeah.
I think also, I mean, you know, it's quite easy nowadays if you're a big name, if there's a controversy going on, to withdraw your stuff. You can do that. There will be a lot of publicity. But then 2 years later, somebody in management or whatever, or your publisher is going to say, sorry, it's a bit tiresome, you know. And, you know, because what are you supposed to do if somebody falls off their twig with their stuff not on Spotify? Are they, you know, are their representatives supposed to restore it or something? You know what I mean? It just seems a fairly untenable stance to take, really.
I think they like the publicity of withdrawing, and they re-enter much more quietly.
Yeah, I think that's generally the case, you know. And I mean, I personally couldn't see what you know. Joe Rogan seemed to me like a really curious hill to die on. I'm not a devoted listener to Joe Rogan, but I've heard and seen Joe Rogan, and you know, there might be things that he wouldn't agree with, but not, I didn't find it oppressive or anything like that, or offensive or anything of that kind. And it seemed a pretty curious thing for
there's a sort of racist dimension to it, isn't there? And also, he's so, I think for them, aggressively right-wing, isn't he? So,
well,
he's not particularly far right.
No, he's not.
I mean, he does interview people all across the spectrum, but the moment you interview somebody, you know, they don't like, that's all that matters. And it's, you know, in thinking about politics and rock and roll, I mean, for many years, certainly the 60s and 70s here, the 80s over there, was policy-based. I mean, there were bands whose whole reputation was based on their political stance. And I mean, if you're going to name your band the Communards, you've pretty much staked out your territory. You know, y'all have been speaking a lot about it lately. You've mentioned the Red Wedge shows that kind of petered out, and the, you know, just a whole bunch of other stuff. And it's more, you know, obviously now it's more political correctness than actual policy type.
That's true.
And cancellations. Because so what got me over here, I started thinking of some of the bands who've changed their names, and it's certainly in country music, you know, Lady Antebellum.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, Dixie Chicks
dropped the Dixie, didn't they?
Yeah.
Chicks.
Although we find the Chicks a bit irksome. Anyway, yeah, you can't really win. Which bit do you drop?
It won't be long.
Yeah.
But I was curious if y'all could think of any others. I went hunting for some who, you know, just went through the whole name change in order to boost their progressive bona fides.
I don't know, really. I haven't kept a check on that. The thing that always fascinates me is it's kind of really interesting looking at the kind of long wave of popular music when you're as elderly as I am. You know, that I always think back to seeing the film of Woodstock in 1969, which starts, as you'll no doubt recall, with Richie Havens stomping it down the street, up and down the stage, singing one word, freedom, freedom, freedom. And I think to myself, how utterly inconceivable it is that in 2024 anybody would make that kind of statement, you know what I mean? Because, you know, that popular music for most of my life was all about the core message was kind of, oh, loosen up, don't worry, you know what I mean? Now it's not. It's the other way. It's tighten up, absolutely, you know. And I think that causes all kind of growing pains, doesn't it? I suppose it's just
and it sits easily on some performers and sits very uneasily on others. You know, you're just thinking of the Beatles and how the Beatles kind of balanced themselves out with John being much more political and social and revolution, and most of the others not even remotely, although I guess Taxman could be considered.
Well, that was the absolutely. Well, it's inconceivable that anybody would write a song like Taxman nowadays, you know what I mean? Partly because the tax regime is a lot looser now than it was in the mid-60s, you know, because George Harrison had a point, I think back then. You see, it's interesting to me that you have these, you know, major issues like, well, any major issue. Pop stars are a lot less willing to rush to the barricades now than they would have been 20 years ago, I suppose.
Well, like they say, you don't want to offend half your
Well, that's precisely it. I really admire anybody who makes their political allegiance clear, actually, because they must run the massive risk of losing a large number of possible followers.
Well, and another field, Jerry Seinfeld, so, you know, I won't play colleges anymore because, you know, just they're perpetually looking for something to be offended by.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, and he was more than willing to provide it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I have great sympathy with him over that. But, let's see how this all turns out, shall we? So, Chuck, what do you do for your birthday?
Well, a week before my birthday, way back, it's been 3 years now, I've been meeting with you gentlemen on my birthday, but the first time we talked about how far I would travel for a gig. Well, I traveled 4 hours up to Atlanta and 4 hours back the same day to see Marshall Crenshaw.
Oh, oh right. Goodness. Really?
Fantastic.
It was really quite good.
Was that worth an 8-hour trip?
It was fun. Yeah, for a 2-hour show. 8 hours in the car for a 2-hour show.
No, but American... The attitude to distance is so different from here. An 8-hour journey in the UK would be just unthinkable.
And then on my actual birthday, which was last Thursday, which on the date that you can write the same way either in Europe or in North America, 4-4, we were in the middle of the Savannah Music Festival, and one of the regulars here every year for that is Ricky Skaggs and his bluegrass band. And, you know, Ricky Skaggs can get just the most incredible players. So that was very, very good. And then 2 weeks from now, probably the reason I'm growing in the beard is the immediate family is going to be here in Savannah playing. So I'm going to meet Lee Sklar and Danny Korchmar.
Oh, right, of course.
Very good.
These are the people who backed Carole King and so forth back in the day.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to that. I'll get to meet Lee finally, a piker compared to his beard.
Yes, absolutely. You've got a long way to go in the beard stakes.
Yeah, even Keith Adsley is envious, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely.
But, and then the next night afterwards, they're going to have a showing of that immediate family documentary that Tommy Tedesco's son Denny did about the immediate family. He had done the Wrecking Crew movie.
Yeah, sure.
And they're going to have the band will all be there the next night, watch the movie, answer questions. Denny Tedesco will be there. So I'm looking forward to that. And finally, my last music gig to kind of close out my birthday month will be somebody we talked about in our first meeting, which is Mother's Finest is going to be back in Savannah.
Oh, my good God. Grief. Who I interviewed in 1979. For the NME, they were fantastic.
And you can add to the list of your septuagenarian still performing, Joyce Kennedy, the lead singer for Mother's Finest. At
brilliant.
76 is still probably putting in more energy than any of the other gang on your list.
God.
So I'm looking forward to that. It's been a good birthday month.
Well, you see, you've got to get a full program of activities. That's very impressive. Well, thanks very much for joining us and for sharing your thoughts.
We look forward to the update in a year's time.
Yeah, we appreciate it.
And we're expecting the beard to be several feet longer.
Yeah.
I'll see you on the quiz soon. I may be late coming out of court, but looking forward to it.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.